Your Humanities Half Hour is brought to you by the Northern Marianas Humanities Council.
Hey, Zandiro, welcome to Your Humanities Half Hour. I'm Catherine Perry. Our guest today is coming to us via phone from Washington, D.C., Mr. Howard P. Willens, author of the new book, History Will Prove Us Right, Inside the Warren Commission Report on the Assassination of John F. Kennedy. Howard, welcome to Your Humanities Half Hour.
Thank you very much, Kathy, for inviting me to participate in this program. I have had a long relationship with the Commonwealth going back to 1972 when I and my law firm were hired by the citizens of the Mariana Islands to represent them in negotiations with the federal government that led to the covenant, which was approved by the people in 1975 and approved by Congress in 1976. My wife, Deanne Seymour, and I came out in 1976 to help the new future Commonwealth draft its first constitution, and I have had several other assignments in the Commonwealth over the last several decades. I have written two books with my wife as co-author about the negotiations and the United States policy in the Western Pacific. I wrote a short book about Guam and its political status situation, and I have most recently written this book about my experience with the Warren Commission back in 1963 and 1964 after the assassination of President Kennedy.
Well, you definitely have some long-standing ties with the Northern Marianas, and I'm sure many of our listeners today are familiar with you, and we'd like to congratulate you on this latest book, which is very timely, of course, November 22nd, 1963, of course, being the day President Kennedy was murdered. What prompted you to write this book?
Well, for many years, the results of the Warren Commission have been criticized and reexamined with respect to the commission's two essential findings. First, the commission concluded that Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin of President Kennedy. Secondly, the commission concluded that there was no evidence of a conspiracy involving either Oswald or Jack Ruby, who killed Oswald 2 days after the assassination in the Dallas police headquarters. And those two events, the assassination and the murder of the alleged assassin, were very spectacular and raised many, many conspiracy issues and concerns, and President Johnson decided to appoint a commission. When I went to the commission, I helped the general counsel of the commission managed the staff, and he asked me to keep copies of everything that went out of the commission, which I have done, and I wrote a personal journal reflecting my experience with the commission. I have, over the years, spoken out occasionally in support of the commission, but I decided as the 50th anniversary approached that I should use my documents and my journal to tell the story of who we were on the commission staff, of what we sought to do, how we went about investigating the assassination, and why I think that the last 49 years have produced no evidence that undercuts our critical decisions.
I've heard that many people remember the exact moment when they found out that President Kennedy had been assassinated, where they were, what they were doing. What was that moment for you?
Well, it so happens that at that moment, I was out to lunch with my boss, who was the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division of the United States Department of Justice. I was one of his two deputies, and he and I went out for a late lunch, and on our way back to the Justice Department, we encountered a young Criminal Division lawyer who cried out that the president had been shot. And so Jack Miller, who was my boss, ran immediately to the Attorney General's office, where he found the Attorney General secretary in tears and learned that the Attorney General was at his home in McLean, Virginia, entertaining the United States Attorney from from New York, Robert Morgenthau. So I was part of the large group of attorneys in the criminal division that listened to the radio and learned shortly thereafter that the president was pronounced dead. And then we learned about an hour later that a suspect had been arrested who was believed to be the assassin. So that's where I was, and we had an initial problem in the Department of Justice to reflect on what we could do to help investigate this matter and, if necessary, prosecute the people involved.
Now, why was it that the Warren Commission had to be formed? My initial thought was, wouldn't this have been a investigation by the FBI? Why a special commission, and how did you come to be a member of it?
Well, that there was a commission appointed for these reasons. First of all, after Oswald was murdered by Ruby, that meant there was going to be no trial. And without a trial of Oswald for the assassination, it was our concern that the public would never be fully informed about the facts surrounding the assassination, bearing on his motive and reflecting on whether he was part of a conspiracy or not. And secondly, there was no federal law, believe it or not, making the assassination of the president a federal crime. So if there had been a prosecution of the assassination, it would have been done by the officials in Texas. So the President Johnson was faced with the possibility that there would be investigations of this matter in Dallas, also by state authorities in Texas, and also by congressional committees who had an interest in ascertaining the facts and getting some publicity in the course of so doing. So President Johnson actually reversed his position and decided that a presidential commission was the appropriate way to develop the facts, hopefully with the goal of clarifying exactly what those facts were, what the motives of the assassin were, and whether or not there was a conspiracy. So the commission was appointed 1 week after the assassination, and 3 weeks later I was told by my boss that the Deputy Attorney General of the Department of Justice, Nicholas Katzenbach, had volunteered my services to the Chief Justice, and I was instructed to go visit with the Chief Justice and the newly appointed General Counsel of the Commission and offer my services and begin to work in organizing and staffing the Commission.
Now, you were one of three who led the supervisory staff of the Warren Commission. In fact, it says here the only living member of that supervisory staff. Who was leading the commission?
Well, the commission itself had seven members, and the Chief Justice was Earl Warren. And then there were four members of Congress, two senators and two representatives who were on the commission, and two very well-known people from the private sector who had extensive backgrounds in government. That included Alan Dulles, who had resigned a few years earlier from being director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and John McCloy from New York, who had been in the Defense Department during World War II, had been the head of the World Bank, had been the head of the Ford Foundation, I believe, and held many other offices. So there were seven members of the commission, and they appointed J. Lee Rankin to be general counsel. Mr. Rankin had been the Solicitor General of the United States during the Eisenhower administration. So he was a liberal Republican from Nebraska. He was very well known to the Chief Justice and respected by all the members of the commission. So they asked him to assume this responsibility of serving as their principal supervisor of the staff. And it was Mr. Rankin's job to find lawyers, both some senior lawyers and some junior lawyers, who would help him conduct the investigation.
Now, you've divided your book by chapters chronologically, chapter 1 being December 1963, The Nation Responds, and chapter 2, very intriguingly, being January 1964, Distrust of the FBI Grows. Why was that?
Well, I want to make clear that although the Department of Justice had no prosecuting responsibilities in this matter, the FBI was one of the important federal agencies, along with the Secret Service and the CIA, that did conduct investigation of the facts pursuant to requests made of them by the commission. So the agencies did play an important role, but unlike some of the criticisms that have aired over the past several decades, the commission conducted its own independent investigation by reviewing all the interview reports and then conducting and seeking testimony under oath from close to 550 witnesses. So that is the basis for our investigation. And so we did depend on the FBI, however, to deal honestly with us and report the facts that they uncovered in an accurate and responsible way. And we learned early on that the FBI was withholding some information from the commission, and that caused great concern within the staff and within the commission members themselves, because that meant we really had to look very carefully at anything that came from the FBI and make sure that it was supported by other evidence. We had no choice but to rely on the investigative agencies and to supplement it with a sworn testimony that our lawyers would develop. It would have been impossible to go out and hire an independent staff of investigators in the short time that we had available, what with the requirements for national security clearances and so forth. So we had to use the agencies, but we also had to make certain that we checked on the information we received and that our lawyers personally interrogated the witnesses under oath before the commission would make any conclusions based on the factual record before it.
You said you found out early.
There's a very big story about the FBI, Kathy. I don't want me to go into it. About
yes, we do.
The fact that Hoover did lie to us about the FBI's handling of the Oswald investigation.
Yes, we would like to hear about that. Is that the information you mentioned that the FBI was withholding?
Well, we didn't learn. We know that there was some limited information that was withheld that caused our concern. We did not learn. That is, the public did not learn about the more serious deception by the FBI for some 11 years until 1975. The important point is this, for your listeners to know. Lee Harvey Oswald had defected to the Soviet Union. He stayed there 2.5 years. He married a Russian woman, and they had a small a daughter when he decided to return to the United States. Well, immediately on returning to the United States, he was interviewed twice by FBI agents in Fort Worth, where his brother lived. He then, after some time going from job to job in Texas, he decided to go to New Orleans. And in New Orleans, he got into some trouble when he was handing out pamphlets on behalf of a pro-Cuba organization called Fair Play for Cuba. He got in a physical encounter with an anti-Castro Cuban exile, and the two of them got hauled into the police station, and Oswald was fined $10 for creating a public disturbance. At that point, he asked to be interviewed by an FBI agent. So there were three interviews of Oswald that were then followed by Oswald returning to Texas after he went to Mexico. And he went to Mexico in an effort to perhaps return to the Soviet Union, and he needed an in-transit visa from Cuba. So he went to the Cuban consulate and the Russian consulate, and he was disappointed in both places. The Cuban clerk told him that they could not provide an in-transit visa unless Russia, or the Soviet Union, as it was known in those days, had agreed to accept him as an immigrant. And the Soviet consulate told him that it would take several weeks to process his request. So he left to Mexico City feeling very frustrated with his experience. And this visit was known to the FBI, as well as some correspondence he had with the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. And so when Hoover appeared before the Warren Commission in May of 1965, he swore under oath that the FBI had no obligation whatsoever to turn Oswald's name over to the Secret Service before the motorcade so that the Secret Service might decide to keep watch on Oswald at the time of the motorcade. So Hoover was very clear that there was no reason to turn the name over to the Secret Service. What we learned 11 years later was that, in fact, in December of 1963, Hoover had directed an internal investigation of his own agency's handling of the Oswald investigation. On the basis of that internal investigation, he disciplined 17 agents and officials for their inadequate handling of the Oswald investigation, and he wrote in his own handwriting on one of the documents that was subsequently made public in 1975 that said, essentially, you have to be out of your mind not to consider this man to be someone that should be referred to the Secret Service. So if the agency had done its duty, and there was some other information that came to light later suggesting that Oswald had approached the local office of the FBI in Dallas a few weeks before the motorcade, and he left a note addressed to the agent who had been trying to find out where Oswald was living, and in that process had gone to interview the woman in the house where Oswald's wife and daughter were staying. And on the basis of those two interviews in early November, Oswald was so angry, he wrote a threatening note to the FBI in an unsealed envelope, and it said essentially, this is a warning. I am going to blow up the police department and the FBI office if you don't stop bothering my wife. So the agent at the FBI read this letter. He maintained later it was not signed by Lee Harvey Oswald, but the receptionist who saw it disagreed, and he did nothing with it. And so the point is, together with all the other information they had, that if this agent had gone out to interview Oswald before November 22, it's very likely there would have been no assassination.
What did the Warren Commission determine was Oswald's primary motive in doing this? It sounds like he just wanted, it sounds like he was trying to protect his wife, but what did you determine was his real motive?
Well, that's one of the major criticisms of the commission, Kathy, is that we did not decide on a primary motive. I mean, there were certainly people on the staff and perhaps on the commission who thought that as a confirmed Marxist, that there was a strong political motive involved here. There were others who stressed his ineffective background and his difficulties as a youth and suggested he really had serious mental or personality disorders, you know, that prompted this kind of action. There were others that emphasized his idea that he was trying to create some government that was superior to either capitalism, which he had experienced, or communism, which he had experienced. And for some reason, he thought that killing the president would demonstrate his disdain for all established institutions of government, and this would be an historic act that would make him a figure for all of history. So there was a range of motives, including a discord and with his wife, marital disputes. His wife turned him down 2 days before the assassination when he invited her to come move into Dallas with him. And they now had 2 small daughters, and she declined to do that. So the next day, when he took the rifle into his new job, which he got long before there ever was a motorcade announced that would go by the building in which he worked, and he took the rifle in, it's clearly that it was his rifle, and there were cartridges and the bullets all came from that rifle, and they were the ones that killed the president and wounded Governor Connally. So my own view is that his sense of himself being a political figure who had the goal of achieving some kind of status that would justify his being so underestimated and left to work in unhappy jobs and with a dissatisfied wife and so forth and so on. We did call on 3 psychiatrists to look at his materials and see if they could help us understand what motivated him. And after looking at the materials and talking among themselves and with the staff, they concluded that, you know, there were many factors that might have contributed to this act, but they could not reach any sort of agreement on any particular motive, whether it was highly personal or related to a political drive or motivation or whatever.
We're speaking today with author Howard P. Willens, who has just published the book History Will Prove Us Right, Inside the Warren Commission Report on the Assassination of John F. Kennedy. And we'll be back to speak with him more after this break.
Are you a senior my high school student interested in telling stories through film or photography? The Northern Marianas Humanities Council invites you to join its first student film festival. Digital films and digital photo montages are being accepted on the theme, What Does the American Dream Mean in the CNMI? The deadline to submit is at 4:30 p.m. on Monday, December 2nd. Cash prizes will be awarded, including $1,000 for first place for each category. For more information on the Student Film Festival, call the Northern Marianas Humanities Council or visit northernmarianashumanities.org. That's northernmarianashumanities.org.
Welcome back to Your Humanities Half Hour. We're speaking today with Howard P. Willens, author of History Will Prove Us Right, Inside the Warren Commission Report on the Assassination of John F. Kennedy. Mr. Willens is the only living member of the three-person supervisory staff of the Warren Commission investigating the assassination, and his book provides a detailed first-hand account of the work of the commission. Howard, you wanted to share a little bit about the history of the commission. Tell us about that.
Well, I think, Kathy, that your listeners know that for the last nearly 50 years has been the broadest range of conspiracy theories advocated by some very smart and thoughtful people. The possible conspirators include the Soviet Union, Cuba, the Teamsters Union, organized crime or the mafia, perhaps anti-Castro Cuban exiles who were offended by President Kennedy's unwillingness to support an invasion of Castro's Cuba. Others have articulated conspiracies involving President Johnson and Oliver Stone in his movie JFK in 1991 spelled out a conspiracy consisting of the military establishment, the intelligence agencies, as well as the White House. So there's the widest possible range of conspiracy theories, and most of them don't have any facts to support them, support the theories, and they particularly always fail to demonstrate why any one of these conspiratorial groups would ever have pick someone as ineffectual as Oswald and unreliable and unstable to assassinate the president. And so, or indeed, no one would have chosen Jack Ruby, a small-time manager, owner of a strip club in Dallas, to silence Oswald. The point is that you cannot only have to identify organizations that might have hated the president or his brother, the attorney general, but you have to find a connection between those agencies and the people who actually did the assassination or assisted Ruby in his murder of Oswald. And our investigation concentrated on those issues to look at all the associations that these men had, and we found no conspiracy. Or to be more precise, the commission said there was no credible evidence in 1964 of a conspiracy. So that opened the door, of course, as it necessarily should, for the possibility of additional evidence being developed over the years, deathbed confessions, retaliations by one organized crime figure against another, or whatever, and no evidence of that kind has come to light. But in 1977, the House of Representatives appointed a select committee on an assassination that was directed to investigate the Kennedy assassination and Martin Luther King's assassination. Now, this committee was created by people who believed there was a conspiracy and that the Warren Commission was incorrect in its main findings. But after 2 years of further investigation, they reached essentially the same conclusion, that Oswald was the assassin and that there was no conspiracy involving any of the groups that I mentioned earlier. Now, they did at the last moment change their conclusion based on some acoustics evidence that they thought demonstrated there had been a second shooter on the grassy knoll. But 2 years later, a National Academy of Sciences committee looked at that acoustics evidence, which was a tape of police communications at the time of the motorcade, and the National Academy concluded that the four waves reflecting sounds, and which the committee believed were four shots, in fact occurred 60 seconds after the assassination. So that effort to create a conspiracy, it just had no foundation whatsoever. And I should also point out that the commission did make some mistakes during its work, for example, in not letting the autopsy doctors look at the actual photographs and x-rays that they produced in the process of conducting the autopsy. These were not used as evidence because the Chief Justice did not want to make them part of the public record. So there was a lot of criticism about that, and as a result, in 1968, in 1975, and again in 1978, the federal government convened groups of independent forensic experts or pathologists to look at the autopsy materials, and all of them concurred with the commission's conclusion that the two bullets that hit the governor and the president in the automobile came from above and behind, namely the Texas School Book Depository. So that was one of the critical findings that was re-examined time and time again. And I think it's important for your listeners to know that the Warren Commission does have this extensive record of being examined over the years. And one reason I wrote the book was to summarize this history after 1964 and demonstrate that notwithstanding all the conspiracy theories, there have been no facts that have undercut our principal findings.
Do you feel that serving on the Warren Commission or revisiting your work in writing this book has changed you in a personal way?
Well, no, there have been several people who've asked me and other members of the staff how this affected our lives, our careers, our marital relations, and God knows what else. And my answer, I think, is generally shared that, you know, it was a terribly important, challenging job. It was the most intense professional experience that we all have ever had. But we all are strongly supportive of the findings and have congregated this past year in defending the commission's conclusions. But most everybody has gone on to future careers. Out of our group, we had one five-term senator from Pennsylvania, three judges, six law school professors, including two deans of Stanford and NYU, a secretary of transportation, and some very founders of major international law firms and so forth and so on. So people demonstrated by their subsequent careers that they were people of substance, of integrity, of competence. And I know that doesn't mean that we were flawless, because we certainly were not flawless, but we did a respectable professional job, and we're all proud of it.
Any final thoughts before we go?
No, I just want to say that I hope the book is available out in the Northern Marianas and in Guam. I hope some of my friends will take the opportunity to take a look at it. And I hope that this interview sort of reminds people of this particular historical event, which has been the subject of so much discussion here on the mainland in the last few weeks. And I hope that there will be some interest in discussing it in high school or in class, because it is something that's a very important part of our history, and I think it's very useful to use it as an example of how history changes our views of events depending upon our own personal status, our biases, and our status in life.
We've been speaking today with Howard P. Willens, author of History Will Prove Us Right, Inside the Warren Commission Report on the Assassination of John F. Kennedy. We encourage you to get a copy of the book. Very intriguing. Howard, thank you so much for making time to talk with us today.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. It was a pleasure.
This has been Your Humanities Half Hour. I'm Katherine Perry.
This program was supported by a We the People grant awarded to the Northern Marianas Humanities Council from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities or the Northern Marianas Humanities Council.